You are listening to a previously recorded broadcast.
So what does an atheist say to an Oxford University professor of mathematics and science who is also a committed Christian and a believer in the Bible?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, it's Friday here on The Line of Fire, which normally means you've got questions, we've got answers. But today it's turned around. I've got questions, and I've got a guest live in studio here with me. Absolutely thrilled to meet him today and to welcome him to The Line of Fire. One of the world's top mathematicians, an Oxford University professor, and a man who confronts the atheists and who believes in the Bible, the Word of God. I'll introduce him in a moment. Michael Brown, thanks for joining us on this last Friday of 2011. If you have a question for my guest, I may get to some, but I'm gonna hog this time. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. You can also post questions on our Facebook page, Ask Dr. Brown, Ask Dr. Brown. My guest, Dr. John Lennox. Dr. Lennox, thanks, sir, for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
All right, before we get into your views about atheism or anything else, I just want to introduce you to our listeners. How many languages do you speak, sir?
Well, I speak English moderately well, I suppose.
Uh-huh. And any others?
And then I speak German and Russian pretty well, and French and Spanish.
Okay. And do you read any other languages aside from those?
Well, I read a bit of New Testament Greek, Italian, and a very little Hebrew.
Okay.
I've got to defer to you, sir, on that.
All right. And then what degree? This may be silly, but I'm doing this for a reason. What degrees have you earned?
Well, I've got a doctorate in mathematics from Cambridge and undergraduate degrees from there as well. And I've also got a doctorate in science. Then that's a higher doctorate that we have in England from the University of Wales, where I taught for many years. And as well as that, I have an MA in bioethics from the University of Surrey. And Oxford have also been kind enough to give me a couple of degrees, but that's because I'm a Cambridge graduate and there's a relationship between the two.
All right. And your official position at Oxford, what's the title of your professorship?
I'm a professor of mathematics at Oxford. And in my college, I'm a fellow of a college, as many of us are. And there I'm fellow in mathematics and philosophy of science.
All right. And I've read about pure mathematics. What is that?
Well, my own field is algebra, which is a turnoff for many of your listeners, I suspect, but I can assure you it's very exciting. So it's abstract pure mathematics, and I spent my life working in that field.
So probably a little bit beyond when I was good in seventh grade algebra. You're probably a little bit advanced beyond that.
I would hope so, or else we're not doing our job.
All right. And you've published papers in mathematics?
I have, yes, and a couple of books I've co-authored, which are basic texts in the theory of abstract groups, which is my speciality.
So give me the title of one of them.
Well, one of them is called, oddly enough, Subnormal Subgroups of Groups, and it tends to be classified with abnormal psychology in libraries by people that don't know. And then I've co-authored a book with a very eminent North American author who's a friend of mine, originally from Scotland. And that's called The Theory of Infinite Soluble Groups. And both of those are in the Oxford Mathematical Monograph series.
All right. And you're a committed Christian.
I am a committed Christian.
You believe Jesus died for our sins and rose from the dead.
I do. I believe Christianity's true.
You believe the Bible is God's word.
I do, yes.
So we got 30 seconds. What if this notion that Richard Dawkins, another atheist, they call themselves the Brights, implying that anyone who's not an atheist must be somewhat dumb. What do you think of that?
Well, I think it's rather arrogant and utterly absurd. You know, Stephen Hawking has come on recently as supposedly one of the Brights, and he said that heaven is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark, and I was asked to comment on it. I said atheism was a fairy story for people afraid of the light.
Yeah, perfect. Perfect. Thank you, sir. All right, we're going to come back with Dr. Lennox on atheism and take your questions. Stay with us.
You are listening to a previously recorded broadcast.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is my joy to be in studio today, this entire hour, with Professor John Lennox, from Oxford University. He is here in the States for a few days doing lectures. He'll be speaking tonight at Southern Evangelical Seminary right here in Charlotte on his new book, which I'm holding in my hand, freshly signed by the author, 7 Days That Divide the World. Dr. Lennox, as I mentioned to you earlier, I was really impressed with the careful treatment of the biblical text and careful treatment of the Hebrew as well. So nicely done.
Coming from you, that's a compliment. Thank you.
All right. And what is your website, sir?
My website is johnlennox.org.
Johnlennox.org. So spell like you're spelling John Lennon, but then put an X at
yes,
the end.
Yes, don't confuse me with John Lennon.
No, absolutely. All right, 866-34-TRUTH. I may get to some calls, but I want to use all the valuable time we have with Dr. Lennox. I first saw your name with your book, God's Undertaker, because I'm not a mathematician, so I wouldn't have known your many publications and related to math, and I'm not a scientist, so I wouldn't have known your contributions there, nor am I a philosopher of science, so we wouldn't have intersected there. But I saw your name with the book, God's Undertaker, Has Science Buried God? And I thought, wow, here's an intellectual, here's a highly trained academic, unashamed of the faith, addressing these things head on, because most of us, to be frank, even if we know the atheists are wrong, or we know a Dawkins is wrong, or sadly a late Christopher Hitchens is wrong, we don't have the ammunition. I can do it with the rabbis, I can do it with other subjects, but we don't have the ammunition. Did you, in your own studies, because you were a Christian first before you became an academic, did you go through a conflict of faith? Did you struggle with any of the claims of science, or did you never see a contradiction between science and biblical truth?
Looking back, I don't think I really struggled because, first of all, I come from Northern Ireland, and that's an unusual place to come from because it has a reputation for sectarianism. But I was very fortunate in my parents, who were Christian without being sectarian, and the biggest gift they ever gave me was they allowed me to think and they encouraged me to read very widely. So I'd read a great deal before I came to university. And at university, I was challenged in my first week. A student said to me, "Do you believe in God?" And then they said, sorry, I forgot you're Irish. You people all believe in God and you fight about it. And I'd heard that before, but what that led to was that I sought from that day on to befriend people who didn't share my worldview. And I discovered through life that the more I exposed myself, both in Britain and in the Eastern European world during the Cold War and latterly in Russia, the more I exposed my Christian faith to other worldviews, the more it confirmed the truth of Christianity. Because that was always the thing that drove me. Is it true? Not is it helpful or whatever, although those questions are important, but is it true? And I found the more I investigated science, you see, sitting here as a scientist in your studio, I'm not ashamed of being a Christian for one very simple reason, because Christianity, the Judeo-Christian heritage, gave me my subject. Mm. I mean, historically, science exploded, modern science, in the 16th and 17th centuries, and people have asked the question, why did it happen there and then? And I think C.S. Lewis, and I'm old now, Michael, I used to listen to C.S. Lewis in Cambridge.
Okay.
But C.S. Lewis formulated it very well when he said men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. In other words, modern science, far from belief in God hindering it, belief in God was the motor that drove it.
All right. And let me just ask you this. I want to, in a little while, raise some challenging questions, be it about evolution, be it about the problem of suffering,
sure,
be it about the authority of Scripture. But just to intersect here with one point, could you explain to our listeners the profound nature of the statement that the universe is intelligible? What does that mean, and how does that reinforce the statement that you just made?
Well, you're hitting on a central theme for me, and it's one of the reasons I reject the new atheism. And that is this: every scientist believes, with Einstein, that the universe is rationally intelligible. That is, at least in part, we can grasp it with our mind. And interestingly, Einstein, obviously one of the greatest scientists who ever lived. He said, I cannot imagine a scientist without that faith. Now, where that cogs into the whole atheist debate is, the atheists have done a clever thing. They have given the public the impression that faith is a religious word and means believing without any evidence. Now, they're wrong on both counts, because faith in the normal sense of the word is a commitment based on evidence, and all scientists are involved in it. Each one of us, whether we believe in God or not, if we're in science, we believe that the universe is intelligible. It's rationally intelligible. Now, here comes the irony. When I ask my atheist friends, what is the justification of your belief that science can be done? You do it with your mind, but what is your mind? They claim the mind is the brain. And what's the brain? It's the end product of a mindless, unguided process. Mm-hmm. But just a moment. If you thought that the computer in your desk was the end product of a mindless, unguided process, would you trust it? And my greatest criticism of atheism in general and the new atheism in particular is it not only undermines belief in God, that's clear, but it undermines the very rationality that's needed to do science. Whereas Christianity, and indeed Judaism, the whole biblical tradition, tells us that the reason we can do science is because the mind in here and the universe out there are both traceable to a rationally intelligible God.
So this the functioning brain that we have, in your view, could not simply be a product of survival of the fittest and billions of years of evolution, hence Dawkins, the greatest show on earth. Look at the wonder of evolution and what it's produced. What's the folly of that, in your view?
Well, I think the folly of it is that there's a lot of confused thought here. And Dawkins has, up until relatively recently, said that Darwinian evolution is the explanation of the existence of life and variation in life. I have no difficulty with many of the things that Darwin observed, that natural selection, mutation create variation. That's clear. We can see that among human beings. Where I become skeptical as a scientist is with the alleged creative power of evolution. Mm-hmm. And of course, evolution cannot by definition explain the origin of life, because evolution depends, whatever it does, on the existence of a mutating replicator. It cannot explain the existence of a mutating replicator. And to cut to the heart of this whole debate, and as you say, my book God's Undertaker is written about it, but this business of intelligibility, what I discover is this, that we have recently got to know that at the heart of life, there's a huge word. It's 3.5 billion letters long, written in a chemical alphabet, the DNA database of the human genome. Now, if we just see the letters of our first name written in the shore, in the beaches of North Carolina, we immediately infer from that an intelligence has been at work. What I find rather curious and interesting, and I sometimes drop this into an Oxford Common Room just to liven the discussion, mm-hmm. How could we look at 3.5 billion letters?
Well, how many is 3.5 billion?
Well, it's 3.5 times 10 to the 9. A billion is 1,000 million. And they're all in the right order, like a computer program. People look at that and they say, that was caused by chance and the laws of nature. I say, wait a minute, where is the evidence that chance, however long a time you give it, and the laws of the nature produce a word, produce something meaningful? And it seems to me that's the heart of the problem with atheism. They've got to believe, because they do not believe in a transcendent God, that the rational comes from the irrational. And that's where my skepticism as a scientist is at its maximum. Whereas the biblical view reverses that. It says, in the beginning was the Word. Mm. God is intelligent and intelligible. All things came to be through him. In other words, it places Word, reason, mind at the beginning and says that mass, energy are derivative. The atheist does the exact opposite. He says mass, energy is primary and everything else is derivative, including the mind, and the mind has developed the idea of God because there isn't a God. And as a scientist, I know which one I would go for immediately.
Yeah, and one is rational, the other is utterly irrational. And one is a faith that's in harmony with reason, and the other is an irrational faith.
Well, the irony of that is that the atheist defined faith to be belief where there's no evidence. I say they're guilty of that.
Exactly. So just we've got 30 seconds before the next break. As a mathematician, does the universe operate on mathematical principle?
Well, of course it does. In part, we think God's thoughts after him. And wasn't it Galileo or Kepler who said that God has written, we can understand the world that God has written into in the language of mathematics?
Mm. So the more you study, the more you look at this, you see that blueprint, that handiwork of God. Okay, when we come back, friends, I want to ask some questions that are perhaps more challenging for most people listening, and then move on to the question of if God made things with such precision and beauty and order, why the mess? Why suffering? My guest, Dr. John Lennox, John Lennox, LENNOX.com.
You are listening to a previously recorded broadcast.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, you know, Fridays normally on the Line of Fire, it's you've got questions, we've got answers. I'll be doing that the next hour, but I have the extraordinary privilege and opportunity of having Oxford University professor Dr. John Lennox with me. His website, johnlennox.org, LENNOX.org. Right before the break, I said .com. And Dr. Lennox, who's been well known as a mathematician and scientist and academic, has become even better known in the popular world now as a man who is debating the atheists, tackling the objections of the atheists. So, Dr. Lennox, just quickly, you've suddenly emerged to our consciousness in the apologetics world with your book God's Undertaker, and you've written out quite a few books addressing these issues. So your book in Genesis 1, which is a wonderful read, 7 Days That Divide the World, and you're lecturing on that tonight here in Charlotte. What are your other recent books?
Well, I've written a book called God and Stephen Hawking.
Which I have.
Whose design is it anyway? Because Stephen Hawking, having sat on the fence as far as the public went about belief in God, has come out for atheism, and he thinks that the existence of gravity means there's no God. And so I tackle in my little book not so much his mathematics. He's a genius. He was at Cambridge around the same time as me. But I show that his logic is very faulty. And that's why I wrote that little book. And then I've got another book that's just recently come off the press, which attacks the moral arguments that atheists use. You see, it seems to me there are two big issues here, Michael. Firstly, there's the God and science debate and the attempt by the new atheists to use the cultural authority of science to banish God. But then Christopher Hitchens, particularly writing a book like God is Not Great, these moral arguments against God and the Bible. And I feel that they are understood often better by the majority of the population. So I wrote this book called Gunning for God, which is deliberately ambiguous. People will take the gun for God, and that puts folk off religion of all kinds. Mm-hmm. And then people will take the gun to try and annihilate God, the big guns of the new atheists. And so I've tried to deal with some of those objections in that book and the big problems that you mentioned just a moment ago, the problem of evil, the problem of suffering. These are the hard problems, and we need to discuss them with sympathy and with understanding, because they're very real to many people.
Yeah, I'm in the early stages of writing a commentary on Job with a special focus on the problem of suffering and even the question of where the new atheists come from. My take is that the greatest shock to Job, the horrible non-answer to all of his pain would be there is no God. That would be the ultimate nightmare.
Well, that is correct. Removing God from the equation doesn't actually solve the problem.
Right.
And a lot of people don't quite see that.
All right. So you've debated Dawkins, Hitchens, Peter Singer, whom some might know as a non-ethical ethicist, perhaps. Before we dive in to some of these questions about suffering and the ones you tackle in the newest book, I have talked to professors. There was a biology professor, I think, with Scripps University out the West Coast, if I'm correct. But he just oversaw research and PhDs, and he was telling me, he's an atheist himself, although, again, there seemed to be a personal disappointment somewhere in his own life in terms of faith. But he was explaining to me that the vast number of biologists that he knows in the upper echelon of scholarship and professorship, almost all of them that he knew were atheists. And obviously the implication is when you look at the evidence, you realize there is no God and there's no need for God. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I would say that the impression often given is that the battle is between science and God. Now, that cannot be the case, because if we look at the top of science, let's take one of the most famous scientific projects of the generation, the Human Genome Project. Its first director was James Watson, Nobel Prize winner, whom I've met. And its second director is Francis Collins, the first director, an outspoken atheist, the second director, a Christian. Now, that ought to be enough to show people there's something more going on here. Mm. This is not just science against God, because here's an atheist who's a very good scientist and a Christian who's a very good scientist. And the way I like to put that is that we'll never be clear about this topic unless we realize the conflict is deeper. It is a worldview conflict, with atheism on the one side, materialism essentially, that this world is all there is, this universe is all there is, there's no transcendence. And on the other side, belief that there is a God who created the universe and sustains it. So the conflict is between those two worldviews, and there are extremely competent scientists on both sides. Not long ago, I met a brilliant American Nobel Prize winner of physics, Bill Phillips, a very keen Christian. So, you know, of course, the statistics, there are a lot of biologists who do not believe in God. But I know fellows of the Royal Society, which is our highest scientific academy in Britain, who are believers. But we don't settle these things with statistics. And I think the crucial thing to see in the debate is it cannot be simply science versus God, because there are many competent scientists who believe in God. Once we realize that the battle is deeper, it's a worldview conflict, then we can ask the real question. And that is, in which direction does science point? Does it really point, as Richard Dawkins claims, towards atheism, or does it point towards God? And I believe, and I've given you at least one historical reason for believing that already, I believe that the very fact that we can do science, and it arose how it did and when it did historically, is a very big pointer towards the existence of a God behind the universe.
All right. I know you can answer this in a minute or less. The standard question.
I may not be able to.
But if not, we'll carry it on to the next segment. An atheist asked the question, if man is so complex that there must be a creator, the creator must be even more complex. So who created the creator?
Standard,
to me, stupid question, but it's obviously meaningful to others.
Well, it's amazing that Richard Dawkins makes that the heart of the God delusion. I had to read that a couple of times before I realized that this question was the heart of it. It is superficially attractive, and I think it's important to take the question seriously and analyze it logically.
I tell you what.
So let's go.
So here's what we'll do. We've got a break. I need to just take care of a couple little in-house things here. We've got a break, and then we'll come back and address this. And Josh in Brooklyn, you'd like to challenge our guest. We'll do that, and then we'll dive into the problem of suffering and evil. Friends, in the greater D.C. area, just another reminder, January 5th, from noon to 1, I'll be speaking at the Family Research Council, a special meeting. It'll be an eye-opener. Speak now or forever hold your peace. So be out there. Just go to AskDrBrown.org. Right on the homepage, you can find the itinerary. And if you don't yet have your copy of Our Hands Are Stained with Blood, the most eye-opening book I've written, most translated book I've written on the problem of anti-Semitism in church history and God's eternal purposes for Israel, get a copy, $15 postage paid. End the year by getting that book. It'll be a good investment. And if you're looking for a place to sink some funds, year-end tax-deductible gift right here, and we'll spread it around the world. 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. One more time, the number 1-800-278-9978. And our guest, Dr. John Lennox, his website, John Lennox, LENNOX.org.
You are listening to a previously recorded broadcast.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us. I'm about to take a caller from someone that does not agree with my guest, Professor John Lennox. But right before the break, we asked the standard atheistic question, which during the break I commented to Dr. Lennox, to do good apologetics, you have to take the objections seriously. But some are hard for me to take seriously, namely this one. If man is so complex that there must be a creator, the creator must be even more complex. Who created the creator? 866-34-TRUTH if you have a question for my guest, Dr. John Lennox. So, Dr. Lennox, back to this. Again, to me, the question itself is a foolish question, yet there are many atheists that take it very seriously. So because it's serious to them, we have to address it seriously. So how do you respond?
Well, I do take it seriously, but let's analyze it. If I ask the question, who created the creator? Let's say, who created X or what created X? I'm assuming before I start that X was created. So the question only applies to a created entity. Mm-hmm. Now, if Dawkins had written a book that created God's delusion, I don't think anybody would have bought it, because we don't need him to tell us that created gods are a delusion. Mm-hmm. We normally call them idols. This is an example of what philosophers sometimes call the simple question, because it precludes certain things without you realizing it. You see, Christians and Jewish people, Hebrew people, and indeed Muslims believe that the God is not created. So the question doesn't apply to God. The central claim of the Christian faith, of the Bible, is that God is uncreated. The Word already was. God is eternal. So to say who created God is to say, oh no, I believe that God is created. But the question works both ways, because in one of my debates with Richard Dawkins, which people can see if they go to fixed-point.org and they can obtain them there, if I put it to Dawkins, I said, you believe that this is a valid question, and indeed it is in a certain sense, because you believe the universe created you. So let me ask your question. Who created your creator? Well, I'm still waiting for the answer.
Of course. All right. So either there has to be a first cause of all things, or we end up endlessly asking the same question with philosophically cannot have a resolution.
That's right. But that doesn't happen, because what happens is that each side comes to what they believe to be absolute. And for the atheist, the universe and the cosmos, that's it. That's the stopping point. That's where the buck stops.
So isn't their position, just in this last minute, logically contradictory, that they are saying that matter, which we know is some type of substance, that matter is eternal, that it has no beginning, whereas we are saying there's an eternal God who by definition has no beginning?
Well, that's right. Some atheists do still believe that matter is eternal. But the thing is this, they never avoid the concept of creation. They deny a personal, infinite God who's a creator, and then they have to attribute to mindless matter creative powers. And that, of course, defies my credulity anyway.
Right, so that they've got this 3.5 billion letter complex formula, which is more complex than
which is asking
program.
Them a lot of questions,
right, which just happened, whereas we're saying, look, I remember seeing William Lane Craig saying that when you discover bones, or let's say you discover just a structure, and you say, oh, we know that people made this from the Iron Age, we can
see, right.
You don't want to ask who made the people, because that's not the question there.
No, it's not the question. And actually, you hit on a very important point. When Dawkins put this to me, that's another aspect of your former question. And it's the idea that the simple, the complex must always be explained by the simple. And the way I illustrate it is this. I find a book called The God Delusion. It's pretty complicated. And then I ask, what is its origin? And I find it's the even more complex mind of Richard Dawkins. According to his argument,
right,
that's no answer at all, because the answer is more complex than the thing you're explaining.
Exactly. All right. Hey, Josh in Brooklyn, you're next. You get to challenge our guest.
You are listening to a previously recorded broadcast.
dancing flame. Send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
If you miss any part of this interview, go to askdrbrown.org and click on the Line of Fire, and you will be able to listen to this entire show later today or certainly over the weekend. The website of my guest, Dr. John Lennox, is John Lennox. That's LENNOX.org. He is a professor of mathematics at Oxford University. He is a respected academician and intellectual and a committed Christian. We're about to dive into the problem of evil and suffering and want to spend a good amount of time discussing that. But I want to grab at least one call. Josh in Brooklyn, New York, thanks for calling the Line of Fire. What question or comment do you have for our guest?
Thanks for having me. I just wanted to say, you know, I feel both sides of the arguments are way off base. As a result, we've had 250 million die because of materialism, you know, which is Darwin and Marx collective. You know, I mean, I don't know if that constitutes an apocalypse or not. But anyhow, you know, on the matter of existence, you know, they say man has developed the idea of God, okay? Well, they admit that, but they won't admit that ideas create suffering and, in fact, exist. Materialism is an ideology that, you know, has killed, you know, over 250 million this past century. Does that idea exist?
Has it created suffering? Dr. Lennox, do you have a response?
I do indeed. I think it's what you say is very important, because often the new atheists in their writings, they blame everything on God, and they point to the Crusades and the Middle Ages and the suffering that has been created within Christendom. And of course, as a Christian, I think that's appalling for reasons that'll come up in a moment or two. But what they often do is airbrush out the fact that in the 20th century, there was more blood shed than any other. And a lot of it is traceable back to the ideology that you refer to. Richard Dawkins loves to quote John Lennon's song, Imagine a world without religious fanatics, without Islamic extremists, and so on. And I agree with that. It would be wonderful to imagine that world. But I am not John Lennon. I'm John Lennox. I've written another song called Imagine, but it goes like this. Imagine a world without Stalin, Mao, and Pol Pot. And I think it's very important historically to realize that atheistic ideologies derived arguably, as John Gray, professor of the history of European thought in London, a world authority and an atheist, so he's not biased here. And he points out that they are directly related to the Enlightenment philosophy. So atheism cannot be exonerated of having massive responsibility for ignoring human life and destroying many people, as you say. So thank you very much for your comment.
All right, Josh, feel free to call in another day and discuss this further with me as well. We can pursue it. But thanks for raising this. You got Dr. Lennox's response, and I'm sure you have some comebacks. But we can discuss that another day. But thanks, sir, for weighing in with the question. And to pursue that even further would take us a bit off the mark. But let's focus then on this issue of suffering. All right, do you have kids?
I have three children, and I have five grandchildren.
Five grandchildren. All right. Do you think that you have more love than God?
I certainly do not.
You're not more compassionate than he is?
No.
All right. He presents himself in the scripture as good and reasonably good. Jesus said, if we, being evil, know how to give good gifts to our children, how much more will he give good things to us?
That's right.
He's compassionate. He hears the cry of the orphan and the widow. He's near to our suffering. And yet, you're telling me that you have no conflict between your religious beliefs, you know, what's stated in the Bible about this God, right? So I'm taking the adversarial position here. And yet, with precision, with extraordinary precision, beyond what any of us know now, because science is still learning about the marvel of the human body and the universe and so on, he creates this with extraordinary precision and detail and care, only to have a world in which right now, there are thousands of babies starving to death. Right now, there are little children dying of cancer and people by the bedside crying and praying to God, and he's not helping them. He created this knowing it was all going to happen, and yet you're going to glibly tell me, well, that God is good and the Bible is true. That seems heartless and even emotionally contradictory.
I'm not going to tell you it glibly, Michael. I feel this problem acutely. I arrived in New Zealand 2 days after the earthquake. I had to meet people who'd been bereaved. I nearly died 3 years ago, but surgery saved my life. And people say, do you thank God for it? I said, yes, but I need to be careful, because in the same year that my life was saved by intervention of surgeon, my sister's brain had an earthquake in it. My sister's daughter at 22, just married, and she died. And all of us face this problem. And I want to say very clearly to people who are listening that my heart goes out to this. We all face this big problem. And I understand my friends, and I have many Jewish friends. I've been in Auschwitz many times, and I wept many times in Auschwitz. This is the hardest problem we face. So how do I respond to it is your question. Well, firstly, I see that there are two problems. There's first the problem of pain. That is what we might call natural evil, tsunamis, cancers, and so on. And then there's a problem of moral evil. And I've tried to look at those two problems in my book. And sometimes people say to me, but look, just don't talk to me about personal God. How can you possibly believe in a personal God for the reasons you've given? I don't believe in God anymore. And by saying that, they think they've solved the problem. And in a sense, they've solved an intellectual problem. The world is just like it is. Dawkins puts it this way at the bottom. There's no good. There's no evil. There's just justice. That's how we have to face it. Well, my response is to say this, that by removing God, you may think you've solved a problem, but you certainly haven't removed the pain and the evil. Mm. You've created now a whole set of problems. Because what do you mean by evil if there is no God? Dawkins, interestingly, as a new atheist, he says at bottom, there is no good, there is no evil, which is why I find it a little bit difficult that he criticizes God on the basis of moral principles that he himself undermines. But let's leave that aside, because this is too big a topic to be dealt with frivolously. How I put it is this: we can argue philosophically for as long as we like what a good God might have, could have, should have done. The fact is, we live in a world which presents us with a mixed picture. On the one hand, we see a lot of beauty, we see care, we see love, we see evidence of a designer's hand. On the other hand, it's really like a cathedral that's hit a bomb. A bomb is hit. You see evidence of a former beauty, but something has wrecked it. And all of us live with ragged edges, if we're honest, mm-hmm. and big questions that we face every day. And so, since we cannot, as far as I can see, come to a satisfactory answer on the basis of philosophical argument, although that's very important, and I do it all the time, I ask myself another question. Is there anywhere any evidence that God can be trusted with those ragged edges? And to cut the long story short, Michael, I think the ultimate answer to this is the cross. Mm-hmm. Now, what I mean by that is this. If that really is God there, if it really is God there, then that tells me that God has not remained distant from human suffering, mm-hmm. but has become part of it.
And that he even created knowing the extraordinary cost that was going to be involved and got right in the thick of it.
Oh, but that's right. But you see, we do that every time we have a child. If I have a child, I know that it's possible that that child may reject me, may hurt me. But I still feel it's worth bringing into existence a being that's independent of me and has a certain freedom of will and decision. Why? Because I think love and relationship is important. Now, it's difficult to project these things backwards, but I think it's worth trying that we can see the kind of situation that God is presented with. He creates creatures outside of himself, but made in his image, that are capable of relationship, that are very special indeed. And he loves them, but he knows that love can only exist in an environment where you can say yes or no. So the big question is, granted that some have said no, has God made a big enough provision to deal with it? Mm-hmm. And this is, of course, the heart of the Christian gospel, that through Christ on the cross, God has done something, something very big, that is vindicated by the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, to give the potential and the possibility for healing at this level and forgiveness. Now, I don't want to be trite about this, because I know people are very hurt. But if you take God out, you have no hope.
No hope. And if there's no God, and then if there's no world to come, there could never be justice, there could never be reward, there could never be retribution.
That is correct.
There could never be a silver lining.
That's right.
To the suffering. All right. And what's fascinating is, as I agonized over this for months, preparing to debate Bart Ehrman last year and came up with a very similar approach. We come back. I want to pursue the image of the cross further.
You are listening to a previously recorded broadcast.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, just very quickly before I get back to the problem of suffering, the cross, a couple of caller questions that I'm just going to ask for time's sake. Joseph in Albuquerque, New Mexico is wondering, do you feel that atheism is an intellectual issue or a heart issue primarily? Just a short response to that.
I think it can easily be both. Because after all, the questions of relationship with God were relating not simply to a theory, but to a person. Mm-hmm. And that's very important. So part of it is intellectual, but mixed up with that is emotional and moral and spiritual. And sometimes it's very difficult to disentangle the two. There are people with genuine intellectual objections, but those can be mixed up with bad experiences and so on. So I find myself very sympathetic to people now. I want to try and disentangle what comes from negative experience, what comes from intellectual thinking and analysis and so on.
So often there is, as you study even the lives of famous atheists, there's some experience that is very traumatic, and then that plays into an intellectual outlook later on.
Well, that can be true, or there's simply a question of will.
Right.
Some atheists have said quite openly, I don't want there to be a God.
Right.
Well, that's very honest.
Right. Not ready to get off the throne of my heart, as one professor told me, an archaeology professor in college.
So okay. You've experienced it too.
Jeff in Chelsea, Massachusetts. And again, just a short response. Do you believe that evolution is the foundation of communism and Nazism?
Oh, I think that would be far too simplistic to say that. I think we must be more nuanced in our understanding of it. There are certain ways of understanding various theories of evolution that certainly played into the eugenics program that was used by the Nazis. But we got to remember that even in the West, there were serious eugenics programs at the time.
Got it.
That needs to be analyzed much more carefully before you can make pronouncements that
okay.
are so strong.
Thank you. All right. When I debated Bart Ehrman, I used this analogy. You've got the earthquake in Haiti. People are screaming, where is God? Where is God? And you look over, just an anthropomorphic picture I painted here, you know, God in human imagery. And I said, people suffering, dying, you're trying to pull people out of the rubble. Where is God? And you see, look, someone says, there he is. And he's on his hands and knees with his fingers bleeding, pulling rocks mm-hmm. off the rubble. Mm-hmm. The one thing that you realize is he didn't just send this in some vindictive way. He cares. And for some mysterious way, he's hurting alongside of us. Is that a picture that you find harmony with?
I do. I don't claim that it satisfies all the rawness emotionally, because you know better than I do, Michael, it's one thing to look at hurt from the outside when you're not hurting. It's another thing to be hurting. Cancer looks very different to the oncologist than it does to the person suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got not only an intellectual question here, we've got a pastoral question, and we've got to face both of them. And it seems to me that it's important to ask the questions and answer them, as I've tried to do in my recent book, Gunning for God. But it's also very important to get to the heart of the way God deals with it, not by sending us a philosophical treatise, but by himself coming into the world and going to the cross. Now, the cross is very profound. What can it mean that God becomes incarnate and dies? But it surely is shouting a message that death is not the end. You see, I would give up on this problem if death were the end. But Jesus didn't only die on the cross, he rose from the dead. And I'm convinced that that is true. As a scientist, I do not buy into the notion that is very popular, Hitchens, Dawkins, all the rest of them, that miracles violate the laws of nature and therefore impossible to scientifically intelligent people. And again, in my book, Gunning for God, I have got a whole chapter on that issue. How can we, as scientifically literate people, believe in the kind of miracles in the New Testament? And it's so important because, you see, if death were the end, then I would stand with the atheists. They have no hope because for them, death is the end. But that's the lens through which they have to view everything.
And if death is the end, then there's no excuse for God not intervening more in
well,
recurrent suffering.
Well, that is absolutely correct. But if death is not the end, then because I believe there's sufficient evidence to see that God is a God of love, I believe that God will sort things out in the end in such a way that if we could only see it now, our questions would just stop.
And if we could have God's perspective, the answer to David Hume's going all the way back to Epicurus, the argument, yes, that God could not be all-knowing, all-good,
yes, that's right,
the all-powerful, that the answer is that he could have a moral justification for creating a universe in which there is so much suffering, the end of which is so wonderful that we look back with him and say, yes, it was absolutely a good, wise, moral choice.
Well, that's right. And there's another point there, as C.S. Lewis makes it, you can't have a moral universe without the possibility of suffering.
Yeah.
You see, God has gifted us with the capacity to be moral beings. People say to me often, couldn't God have made a world where there was no sin? Of course he could. We'd all have been robots, but then there would have been no love. And it's hard for people to get their minds around that. These are big things.
Yeah, and somehow, as we're running out of time here, Gunning for God is the book that focuses on this the most, folks. Gunning for God, John Lennox, L-E-N-N-O-X. The fact is that the cross tells us that God cares about suffering and gets involved with it, even if we don't have a resolution to our current suffering, even if you lose a relative to an aneurysm, yeah, at a young age, even to those whose kids are in terrible pain and suffering, that there's the deposit and down payment and somehow God's comfort and presence now to assure the future.
That can be real, even though we're experiencing rawness and hurt and pain. The cross is a window into real hope that the resurrection backs up. That's the beginning of it.
Yes. Dr. Lennox, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us. Our next hour, we've got a lot of local Charlotte listeners, so I'll be pointing them all to your lecture tonight. But thanks again for your time. And what a joy to sit here and see your smiling face and hear your compassionate heart. Join with a brilliant mind, a great combination. The atheist's worst nightmare, I say. But thank you, sir.
It's my pleasure.
And friends, great opportunity at the end of the year to sow into this work, to stand with us as torchbearers. The number to call, 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978. And my bottom line today, friends, in light of the awesome care of an awesome God who created so diligently, so beautifully, so masterfully this universe and you and me, don't think for a minute that he doesn't have a specific plan for your life. We come to the end of 2011. We're about to enter 2012. What is the will of God for you? How can you bring him the maximum glory? Have a blessed new year. We will be back with you the first of the year on Monday. Continue to exalt and glorify Jesus the King. Again, my guest today, Dr. John Lennox, his website, John Lennox, LENNOX.org.
You are listening to a previously recorded broadcast.
Well, we are here to take your questions. We'll answer some difficult questions, including how to do a Hebrew word study.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Friends, I want you to know that I am really enjoying this journey. I have struggles, challenges, burdens, pressures like everybody else, but I'm really enjoying this journey of following the Lord and being His son and being His servant. And just had the joy this last hour of interviewing a brilliant intellectual professor at Oxford University of Mathematics and Science, Dr. John Lennox, author of quite a few books now, Tackling the Atheist. And he's in the greater Charlotte area for a few days. Anyone in Charlotte tonight, Southern Evangelical Seminary, be there for his talk on 7 days that divide the world, his talk on Genesis 1. And then you can catch the broadcast later today or over the weekend at AskDrBrown.org. Click on The Line of Fire. You can listen to the archive show. But it's Friday, which means the rest of this hour, this entire hour now, you've got questions. We've got answers by God's grace. We'll do our best to provide you with solid biblical answers to any questions you have in any areas of expertise that I have. Here's the number to call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884, online, askdrbrown.org. All right, I've got some e-questions here. It's our last broadcast of 2011. From my heart, thank you for listening. Thank you for being part of the show. You know, there's always the twinkle in the eye of people that I meet that tell me, hey, I listen to you all the time. I listen to you as I drive. I'm a truck driver. I listen to you. My family, we listen to you. Wherever the setting or circumstance is, and we get to meet for the first time, there's always a twinkle in your eyes, you tell me, and probably a twinkle in my eyes as you tell me. So thanks for being part of the broadcast. Thanks for listening. Some of you for years, some for months, some for days. Thank you. We are looking forward to an extraordinary 2012, a year of real Jesus revolution. Before I go to your calls, I want to take some e-questions, beginning with Dave. Good morning and Merry Christmas to you and your family. This came in December 23rd. I've been a listener for about a year now and have enjoyed your grace and knowledge. I'm usually in my car from 2 to 2:30, daily listening on WAVA 105.1 FM. So I would have answered this earlier, but I had a special guest. I've just finished a great book titled Emmanuel in Our Place, See Christ in Israel's Worship. It's a great primer to the study of Leviticus and the sacrifices and what they meant to Israel, what they mean to the church today. Would love to hear your comments about this book and subject. Dave, I haven't seen the book, but I'll definitely take a look at it as I'm able to. But I'll say this. Years ago, I was reading through the scriptures, going through the Bible, and as I was going through the Bible, I mistakenly said yesterday, the first hour, that it took me like a year and a half to read the scriptures through the first time. Actually, I read the scriptures through cover to cover about five times my first year and a half in the Lord. Maybe it was 6-7 months the first time as I was just getting into the Word more and more. But I remember one time I was reading through the Bible, and I was in Leviticus, and I seemed dry. I was not getting much out of it, the first 6-7 chapters, just with details about the sacrificial offerings. So I went and read Hebrews. I read Hebrews through. And as I read it through, my heart, my mind stirred afresh. And after that, I then went back and read Leviticus. And wow, the imagery, the spiritual imagery, the spiritual insights, the sacrifices as pointing to Jesus and then pointing in certain ways to our dedication to God and fellowship with Him. So absolutely, as we see Messiah's place in Israel's worship or what these things point to or symbolize or mean, from there's a lot of opening of heart and mind in terms of our own relationship with God and in terms of the meaning of the sacrifices and the sacrificial system to us today. But I will take a look at the book as I have time and opportunity. All right, we'll be back with your calls.
Change the world. You are listening to a previously recorded broadcast.
Cleansing flame, send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today on the Line of Fire, our last broadcast of 2011, and we're taking your questions. I plan on Monday's show, starting off the new year, with some real inspiration, some real encouragement, some real challenge, some things that'll stir your hearts for the new year. So be listening. We will be coming your way live. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. I'm going to go to the phones in one moment. But the question I answered, the first part, by Dave, who was wondering about the book, my take on the book Emmanuel and Our Place, Seeing Christ in Israel's Worship. It is written by Tremper Longman. It came out about 10 years ago. Tremper Longman III is a colleague of mine. He is one of the world's foremost evangelical Old Testament scholars. In fact, he was the co-editor of a series when I wrote my book, Israel's Divine Healer, for Zondervan years ago. He was the Old Testament editor for the revised edition of the Expositor's Bible Commentary series, where I have the Jeremiah commentary. So I've gotten to work closely with him. Solid Christian and a great Old Testament scholar. He's written commentaries on a number of Old Testament books. His Job commentary, I'm looking forward to be out, I think, this coming year, because I've got my Job commentary I'm working on. So anything Tremper writes is going to be solid, sound, in terms of its Christology and in terms of its Old Testament scholarship. So just wanted to mention that. 866-34-TRUTH. Michael in Wesley Chapel, Florida, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on the air. I had a question about, I can't find any evangelism training materials that a church could use to train people in soul winning that comes from a perspective that a person can lose their salvation. Everything that I found on the market comes from a once saved, always saved perspective. And mm-hmm. I wanted to see if you had any recommendations on any evangelism training materials that would not give people just the impression of just say this quick prayer with me and you've got your ticket punched, in light of the fact that I don't know if you've seen the statistics like Ray Comfort had in his book,
right?
Anywhere between like 90 and 95% of the people who say a salvation prayer, they immediately fall away. They're not even in a church service even the following week.
Yeah, because they haven't been really properly led to the Lord. In other words, if they had really encountered God, those statistics would be different. But when they're just going along with praying a prayer, they've never been convicted of sin, they don't recognize their need for God, they have no real idea of who Jesus is, it's almost inevitable that we'll have that. And obviously these people, I would question whether they were ever saved at all. Now, so you're familiar with Ray Comfort's material, but you're looking for actual training material for churches, and you haven't found any in any of Ray Comfort's stuff. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, because even with Ray, and I like Ray, I respect him and everything, but even with his materials, they do teach people that, you know, he comes from, you know, his presentation is on, you know, showing people that they violated the law, and that
right.
His perspective is once they see that they have actually violated the law with their sins, then they'll realize that they do
yes.
have a need for a Savior because of the sins that they have committed, the laws they have broken. And but from that point, if they still go ahead and pray, that prayer that he does teach also that they are once saved, always saved, that they will have eternal security if they were, you know, truly sincere and were really saved at that moment.
Yeah.
But the
and
thing
you know,
is,
Michael,
is people
yeah,
do fall
yeah, yeah,
away
let,
as
yeah,
well, even if they had a true
yeah,
conversion.
Yeah, let me just jump in. The fact is, we've got no business telling someone that once you pray this prayer, once you're in, you could never lose your salvation. Even if someone believes it, they've got no business saying that. What they need to tell this person is, here's how to please the Lord, here's how to live for him, and he's promised to keep you. In other words, the Bible never presents to people this thing, hey, once you get in, you could never lose your salvation. It presents absolute comfort and assurance to those that want to follow the Lord that he will get us to the destination. And then it gives us warnings about not getting off track. Now, Michael, I need you to stay on hold and get your contact info to Dwight, who's taking calls today, because I could tell you about hands-on places where you could, you know, be trained in evangelism and so on. But your question about a curriculum for a church to use, I have to look into that and check with some of my team here. So Michael, stay on hold. Dwight's going to get your contact info. An email is obviously the best thing, all right? And then we will have someone on our team get back to you with some recommendations. Off the top of my head, as far as curriculum, church-based curriculum for training in evangelism that would have that particular theological bent, I'm not sure. So stay on hold, Michael, and we'll get back to you shortly with some recommendations. I always do my best to have an answer to any question that comes in on the spot, but here and there we need to check and do some research on some things ourselves. Okay, Alfonso asked a question, and this comes up constantly, but we'll answer it briefly again. Dear Dr. Brown, according to the Holy Scriptures, which is the day in which the Creator God expects his people to worship him? Is it the Lunar Sabbath or is it Sunday? Can you please provide scriptural evidence or verse reference in your answer? The scripture that I recently read regarding this matter is found in Isaiah 66:23. So, Dwight, when you get a minute, just get back on the line with Michael so you can get his contact info, and then we'll follow up with him. All right. Alfonso, first, in answer to your larger question, the Creator expects his people to worship him every day. He expects us to love him with all of our heart, soul, mind, strength, 24/7, which I'm sure you understand and believe. So that's the first thing. I want to be clear on that, that God expects us to love him heart, soul, mind, strength, 24/7, and to worship him every day of the week. Now, he gave Israel the seventh-day Sabbath as a sign between him and them. It does not say in Genesis 2 at creation that God established the Sabbath for all mankind. You might argue from Isaiah 66 that in point of fact, in the age to come, that there will be universal seventh-day Sabbath worship. Could be, all right? But there's no New Testament scripture that says that God mandated seventh-day Sabbath worship or day of rest for the entire body. Because of which, I say that believers are free to set aside any day of the week as a special day of worship and gathering. And if Jewish believers in particular feel Saturday Sabbath, that they're going to keep that, wonderful. And if Christians feel convicted to do that in general, fine. But I'm perfectly fine culturally if Sunday's a day off and Sunday's a traditional day to gather, that we do it. But there's no New Testament command to do that. I'm not getting into extended discussion because we answer this constantly. All right. 866-34-TRUTH, Jim in Greensboro. All right, we lost Jim in Greensboro. And, okay, let me try to get to another question here. Oh, let's see. Okay, from Deacon Larry. Hi, Doc. I'm a new Line of Fire listener in Philly area. Since the fall, I have recently become a prophecy student, and the revelation of our Messiah through the perspective of Hebrew history and tradition has made my Christian faith grow deeper and wider. Your radio broadcast has helped me in the understanding and the application. Thank you, Deacon Larry. You are quite welcome, sir. Recently, I learned the name of an important rabbi of the nation of Israel, Yitzhak Kaduri, apparently very orthodox in Judaism and highly revered. He reportedly left a note to be opened upon a year after his death in 2006. He was like 110 years old. Upon opening his note, the bearer interpreted the written message as his personal testimony of a revelation that the identity of the Messiah of prophecy is Yeshua of Nazareth of the Christian faith. Okay, what happened with Rabbi Kaduri, he was a highly respected mystic. He was a student of Kabbalah and Zohar, and perhaps the leading mystical rabbi in Israel, with some odd beliefs too. He was a heavy smoker, cigarette smoker, that there was something spiritual about that. But anyway, a revered rabbi. And like I said, well past 100 years old when he died. And he had claimed to have seen the Messiah at some point in his life. He'd seen the Messiah. And he was going to reveal the name of the Messiah 1 year after his death. So after he died, they then opened up this letter that he had and confirmed in his own handwriting. Some tried to dispute it, but confirmed in his own handwriting. And it said specifically that it's a sentence written, and then the first letter of each word spells out Yehoshua, Joshua, or Jesus. It created quite a stir. Was he saying he had seen the Messiah, and the Messiah's name was Yehoshua, Yeshua, Jesus? Obviously, many Messianic Jews, Christians around the world, were very excited about this and said, my God, look at this. Look at what happened. He had an encounter with Yeshua. Others were skeptical and tried to deny it. But I have friends that really believe this thing is real and that he really encountered the Lord. So that is your answer. We'll be back. You are listening to a previously recorded broadcast.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us this last broadcast of the year. Again, I had on the first hour today special guest Dr. John Lennox. Every one of you in the greater Charlotte area, if you're free tonight, get out tonight. Get out tonight to Southern Evangelical Seminary. Just go to ses.edu, and you can hear Dr. John Lennox speaking on 7 days That Divide the World, his book on Genesis. If you've got questions, we've got answers. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Okay, let's go to the phones. Jim in Greensboro, North Carolina, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Good afternoon, Dr. Brown. How are you doing?
Well, thanks.
Good, good. I have a question pertaining to the virgin, the miraculous birth of Jesus. First of all, I'd like to say that I am a believer. I believe in the virgin birth. In this day and time, medical science has become so advanced.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and I'm not sure, now, I asked one or two people, and I didn't get an answer. And I asked somebody else, and I did get an answer. In this day and time, I think it might be possible for a virgin to be artificially inseminated and give birth to a child. I wouldn't, and if it were to happen, I wouldn't call it a miracle. I might call it a quasi-miracle. What's your take on that?
Well, certainly, any woman who's of age, you couldn't artificially inseminate a 4-year-old and produce a baby, obviously. But once the woman is in her monthly cycle and there's a potential of having a child, of course she could be artificially inseminated, and she could have a child. That would be no miracle. I'm sure there are virgins who are artificially inseminated who have children. Obviously, the question here is, is, can this be explained naturally in terms of the Messiah's virgin birth, or is it supernatural? The Bible presents it as supernatural.
Yes.
In other words, even if there's a 1,000 scientists in the world who say it's impossible, it means nothing because God did it, and God's the creator, and he has the power to do it, and it was supernatural versus natural. Now, will science ever discover a way? Here's possible for a virgin to give birth. It could be, but that doesn't matter to me either way, because God did it. God orchestrated it by his supernatural power. And because he's the one that set all the laws in place, and he works in this world however he wants. And I know this is a separate issue, but there's this philosophical, scientific idea that miracles can't exist because they violate the laws of nature. Well, it's silly when you recognize that God is at work in the world, that he's actively at work. He didn't just set it up and leave it. So he's actively at work, and he's doing all kinds of things. And the whole teaching of the virgin birth, as it's laid out, especially in depth in Matthew 1 and in Luke 1 and 2, is that it's a complete miraculous thing. It is the work of the Holy Spirit doing impossible things, and therefore it's the age of the impossible. Nothing is impossible with God. That's what Gabriel proclaims to Miriam, Mary, the virgin who gives birth to the Son of God. Hey, Jim, thanks for calling, man. I appreciate it.
Sure.
And let me just take this further. The bigger issue is she gave birth to the Son of God, an even bigger miracle than the fact that it was a virginal conception and birth. All right. Matt wants to know, Isaiah 53:5, where the word stripe is used, is that a valid translation of the Hebrew word, and how is that determined to be used? Thanks for your insight. You're speaking of Isaiah 53:5, where it says, Uvachabarato nirpalanu, and by his wounds, or at the cost of his wounds, there is healing for us. Chabura is a wound or a bruise or a stripe in the sense of a wound or a bruise. Those that would not use the word stripe in that sense today, just like stripes and colors, okay, that's a different stripe. That's a different word entirely. But chabura, we understand the word. There's not much mystery in it. It's a wound. It's a bruise. It would be something that could be seen externally, and hence, stripe would be something that worked accordingly in terms of the way stripe was used in the past. So it's stripe from a whip. That would be something that Chabura could refer to as well. All right, to the phones, Scott in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Yes, Dr. Brown.
Yes, sir.
I mean this in love, because and I need to study that more probably, but it says if a person comes to you with a teaching that doesn't align with the message of Jesus, don't welcome that person or greet him, because if you do, you'll be a partner in advancing his wicked agenda. How far do you go with that?
When it's taught, when John writes that and gives that counsel in his letters, he's talking about aiding someone in their mission. In other words, Paul has already told us, sir, in 1 Corinthians 5, that we can't leave the world. When he says, don't associate with someone who's immoral, he said, I'm not talking about in the world, right? He said, I'm talking about in the church. If someone claims to be a follower of Jesus, I'm a brother, I'm a sister, I'm a follower of Jesus, and I'm living in active adultery, or I'm living in active alcoholism or whatever, and I won't repent, then you disfellowship that person with the hope that they will repent and turn and get right with the Lord. Now,
if you just ignore him, he says you can't even greet him. That sounds awful cold.
No. Right. Well, hang on. We're talking now, the specific question you ask is about a false teacher, okay? And what John is talking about when he addresses that issue is that if a false teacher comes to you, okay?
Uh-huh.
Someone comes who is a false teacher, who is spreading heresy, right? And that it was the custom when you were a traveling teacher that someone would welcome you in their home, right? Remember the
right.
Disciples traveled out and Jesus
right.
said, just stay where, okay, so it's not that you're going to be put up in some five-star hotel somewhere. You're an itinerant teacher. You're preaching the gospel. You arrive in a new place. You've got a letter from Timothy saying that you're a trusted brother. So the saints there, they put you up in their home. They receive you. And then they try to get some money together to send you on your way so you can make it to the next place where you're going to be teaching and preaching and ministering. In the case of a false teacher, he's saying, no, absolutely not. Don't receive him. Don't greet him. This person who is a false teacher, a willful false teacher spreading heresy, is to be utterly rejected.
But the difference between brethren, differences in opinion between brethren is no cause for fear.
No, absolutely not. We are a big, diverse body, and look at it like this, Scott, and I appreciate the sincerity of your question. You want to honor the Lord and honor the Word, but look at it like this. If we're going to be with someone forever and ever, it's great for us to be with them now, and that's the biggest thing. And the big issue is those spreading heresy should not be welcomed by the body and supported by the body and sent on their way. They are to be rejected and marked. But if it's a brother or sister with a difference, we welcome those differences and go on in the Lord. All right, Scott, you have an awesome end of the year and a great new year. We'll be back with your calls and questions.
You are listening to a previously recorded broadcast.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
In this last half hour of our broadcast, the last of 2 hours, it's my joy to welcome listeners from different parts of the country that just get this last half hour, and perhaps you get other broadcast repeats later in the day, or you come online, catch everything. So I want to especially greet again everyone who's been part of the show these months, for some of these years. Thanks for listening. Thanks for a great 2011. We're looking forward to an amazing 2012 in the Lord, and plan to start with a blast on Monday. So be with us live on Monday and press into the Lord, enjoy Him, and get a fresh heart, fresh start for the new year. I often take time at the end of the year to reflect. I'll read through journal entries. I'll read through key things that have been on my heart and I feel that the Lord's required of me or given me to do, and reflect and ask questions, and then move ahead with zeal and purpose. That's what we want to do here on The Line of Fire. And I have an article that's scheduled to come out Monday, but I'll talk about it on Monday, that is sure to generate some heat. But I'll tell you about it on Monday. Okay, because I don't want to distract today. You've got questions. We've got answers. If you did not listen online, then you missed a fabulous first hour, my interview with Professor John Lennox, a mathematician, scientist from Oxford University. Brilliant man, full of compassion, loves the Lord, and a committed follower of Jesus, believes the Bible to be God's word. It was a delight to have him on. Everyone in the greater Charlotte area, join him at Southern Evangelical Seminary tonight, ses.edu, for his presentation on 7 days that change the world, as he talks to us about the book of Genesis, chapter 1. A question from Nia. Thank you for your ministry. What are your thoughts regarding the NLT version of the Bible? I find it a very clear read. Someone was explaining to me that it's not very accurate in its translation. I personally haven't seen that. When I compare some verses in the NLT to other versions, NIV or New King James, those verses in the NLT seem to tell me the same message, so I don't see where it's inaccurate. Please tell me your thoughts on the NLT. Also, what would you recommend as your top three versions for the average reader that is not necessarily a theologian or PhD? Thank you. Nia, I often address the issue of Bible translation because it's very important, and because it plays into areas of some expertise in my own life, especially with Old Testament. So NLT I use frequently in a secondary way. Now, sometimes I'll read through large portions of the Bible in the NLT, just reading through kind of quickly and getting the feel and the flow and things like that. But I don't use it as my primary translation. I don't use it as my primary translation in English, that is, for one reason, which is it is a mild paraphrase. There was the old Living Bible, which had some value and was loved and it was hated because it was a paraphrase. It was not an actual translation. It was a paraphrase. The NLT is very close to what we call a dynamic translation. In other words, not so much word for word, but more thought for thought, which has complete validity based on going from one language to another, but then has weaknesses because it will often miss the specific usage of a specific word and what it's trying to convey, especially when the same author may use the same word a certain way. The NLT is slightly past a dynamic translation and is a mild paraphrase, but done by top scholars. So if English is your second language, NLT is a great version to use. If English is your first language, I would use NLT in a secondary way. In other words, I would be doing my studying in another translation, and then I would be using NLT because it's so often brings out the meaning of the verses better than just about any of the other translations, but sometimes it brings out a meaning that is more disputable and therefore will get you away from the exact text. So I'll come back to that. I'll give you an example and then answer the rest of your question on the other side of the break. You are listening to a previously recorded broadcast. What's wrong?
right. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire broadcast. Hey, have you gone to the blog yet? Because of the holidays, we don't have our full staff here working on things, so I don't have the blog address on our homepage yet. But for those who want to check it out, please go there. It is Line of Fire blog, lineoffireblog.blogspot.com. Jot that down, lineoffireblog.blogspot.com. I've got a few posts up there. I've got a journal entry from India in 1994 where I was just testing things out on the blog that you'll still enjoy reading. We've got the 9.5-minute video of my trip to India that's gotten hundreds and hundreds of views since it's gone up, and a number of comments of people really impacted by it. What you can expect on this blog, I've got that up, and then an example of the latest fun hate mail that I got, which actually prompted me to write an article scheduled to come out Monday. Like I said, I'll tell you about it on Monday, but if you want to preview it bright and early Monday morning, go to townhall.com and you'll find it. In fact, I'll tell you the title of it. I'll tell you the title of the article. It's Why Are Ron Paul's Followers So Touchy? Sorry. I better not go there. Better not go there. And I'm not a critic of Ron Paul or a supporter of Ron Paul. It's just a question and an observation. I give people opportunity to tell me if I'm not being fair. But don't call about that. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Online, askdrbrown.org. Click on the Line of Fire. So back to the NLT. I often use it. I just answered a question someone was asking by sending them renderings from the NLT. I remember Pastor Don Wilkerson preaching for us at Fire some years ago, and because he's constantly doing inner city ministry, ministry to drug addicts and things like that, he said often with his team, they're trying to look for a way to convey something, and they're using a particular scripture, and then they're looking for a verse that conveys it most powerfully, and they've often found the NLT doing it in a beautiful way. But I'll give an example. Because it's a paraphrase, it can sometimes really miss things. So Galatians 6:16, I'll read it to you in the King James. And as many as walk according to this rule, peace be upon them in mercy and upon the Israel of God. New American Standard, those who walk by this rule, peace and mercy be upon them and upon the Israel of God. English Standard Version, and for all who walk by this rule, peace and mercy be upon them and upon the Israel of God. NET, and all who behave in accordance with this rule, peace and mercy upon them and on the Israel of God. Now, the NIV, I believe, wrongly renders it. The recent version of the NIV, peace and mercy, told to follow this rule, dash, to the Israel of God, because it's best translated as and, as all these other versions have. In other words, Paul is pronouncing a blessing on the Israel of God, meaning the Jewish remnant of believers, not calling the church Israel, hence all these other translations. Complete Jewish Bible, and as many as order their lives by this rule, shalom upon them and mercy upon the Israel of God. The NLT completely misses it here, completely blows it. And it says this, it says, may God's peace and mercy be upon all who live by this principle. They are the new people of God. So it gets rid of the Israel reference there. It just has it completely wrong, completely wrong. I'll read it again. May God's peace and mercy be upon all who live by this principle. They are the new people of God. Now, the footnote says this principle, the Greek, this principle, and upon the Israel of God, but that's just showing you how much it changes things. So that's why I use it in a secondary way. If I was picking three translations to use, though, the ESV is excellent, although I don't agree with it at every point. I find it smoother than the New American Standard Bible, which, while it strove for accuracy, often was too stiff. So I find the ESV an improvement on that. The NIV, I still love to preach from and read from. However, sometimes because it gets the English so nice, it does it at the expense of Greek word order or something that could convey things just a little bit differently. And then if you want, as a third version, NLT, absolutely. I just wouldn't use it as primary. Now, we've done other shows talking about different Bible translations and things like that, so I'm not going to do that again now. Larry, we didn't bring on the air, had a question when I talked about Sabbath observance earlier in the broadcast, that God did not command Seventh-day Sabbath for the entire church, although people are free to make it a Sabbath day. I'm not getting into that in depth again because the questions comes up time and time again. I've written on it. Read my book, 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices. I've addressed it many different ways. We've talked about it on the air. We've done whole shows on it. But simply stated, the New Testament does not give us a mandate to all believers Seventh-day Sabbath. It simply doesn't. You say, well, the Gentiles would have learned it from the Jews. Well, in many cases, that's not the case. They went from idol worship to faith in Jesus. And many of them did not end up in the synagogue and learning in that way. So the question came up from Larry. Well, is there a verse regarding Sabbath in the New Testament that says you can pick a day? Well, Romans 14 really addresses that. Even if it was not initially addressing the question of Sabbath, it certainly applies. It certainly applies. And here, I'll read Romans 14. I'll read it from the NLT so you can hear it as brought out there. By the way, for those that love the King James, I just recommend using the New King James. It doesn't have the literary power, but it is updated in so many important ways that I certainly would highly recommend that. Paul brings out a principle. Romans 14, 4, who are you to condemn someone else's servants? They are responsible to the Lord, so let him judge whether they are right or wrong. And with the Lord's help, they will do what is right, will receive his approval. In the same way, some think one day is more holy than another day, while others think every day is alike. You should each be fully convinced that whichever day you choose is acceptable. Those who worship the Lord on a special day do it to honor him. Those who eat any kind of food do so to honor the Lord, since they give thanks to God before eating. And those who refuse to eat certain foods also want to please the Lord and give thanks to God. And that, for me, is a bottom line principle with this issue in the New Testament. Okay, Micah. I learned how to do a Hebrew word study years ago from one of your sermons, the one on Acharit, I think. The Hebrew charutz is a bit confusing to an English speaker. Can you recommend somewhere to learn about what it means? I'm using Strong's Concordance, but I know that's not perfect. All right, first thing to reiterate, Strong's Concordance was a concordance of the King James, and the best. Young's is excellent at being topical, but Strong's being exhaustive and laid out the way it was is the best. And if you know how to use it, when you see the different numbers which key to the dictionary in the back with each word, if you know how to use it, that's great, because you'll find out, okay, this word, they translate it this way, this way, this way. Here in the King James, this is the same word here, 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 here. That's useful to know if you can't read Hebrew or Greek. The dictionary in the back of Strong's for the Greek is okay, for the Hebrew is unreliable. And primarily the dictionary is there in a secondary way. It's basically telling you first all the different ways that this particular word was translated by the King James translators. It's not even giving you, in every case, the best definition of the word, but simply how they were translated, all right? Especially some of the definitions are based on older theories or speculative. So the problem is, if it's got 8 exactly right and 9, 9th one not perfect and 10 way off, how do you know that if you don't know the language? Therefore, I do not recommend that people use the dictionary in the back of Strong's Concordance, in particular the Hebrew, all right? And these days, there's almost any good Bible software that's out there. I mean, you name it. The Bible software that's out there, some inexpensive, some expensive, can key you to key dictionaries. So when you just hover over the word, it can tell you this is the Hebrew word, this is the Greek word, and here are the top dictionaries and what they mean, okay? Whether you're using the Bible Works program, which is an expensive one, it's several hundred dollars, but what I have on my desk always and is massively important just in terms of textual study, whether you're using that, whether you're using PC Study Bible, whether you're using the massive logo software and so much that's available there, it's very easy now to get software where you like right now, as I'm using Bible Works, I'm looking at Romans 14:2 in Greek, and I'm looking at the word pistoue, believes, and when I just hover the cursor over it, it'll give me the definition of the word. Okay, it'll give me further details about it. And then when I just look over in the resource window, it'll give me this word in Freiburg's Analytical Greek Lexicon, in the Low Nida Greek English Lexicon of the New Testament, which is based on semantic domains, on Thayer's old but still valuable Greek English Lexicon of the New Testament, of the authoritative Arndt Gingrich Bauer Lexicon, Greek New Testament Lexicon, etc. So that's all just at the fingertips, and you just click on it, and you say, okay, so this is what it means in these different dictionaries. So there's plenty of software available like that, and it's very easy to use, and it keys you in with the best sources. Now, how to do a proper word study? I want to come back on the other side of the break and explain that. You are listening to a previously recorded broadcast.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You know, the funny thing is when people are going to argue with me about Romans 14, I don't you think I understand the pro-Seventh-day Sabbath arguments? Do you actually think 40 years in the Lord as a Jewish believer, and with many of my friends being Messianic Jews, for whom Saturday has been Sabbath in their lives for decades, and with many of my best friends living and ministering in Israel, for whom Seventh-day Sabbath is sacred, and even having friends who are Seventh-day Adventists over the years, and myself, if I am not preaching or teaching, then Saturday is the number one day of the week for me to refrain from normal work. You don't think I give you the arguments from Genesis 2 all the way through the Old Testament, through the New Testament, on behalf of Sabbath? The fact that I quote Romans 14 means I do it knowingly, understandingly, and saying the principle applies to Seventh-day Sabbath, and I will repeat, nowhere does the New Testament command all believers to set aside the Seventh-day Sabbath. It simply doesn't. In fact, it would have been impossible with Gentile world, Gentile believers, because of the schedules they had, or, you know, slaves. Okay, Ten Commandments say that slaves are not to work on the seventh day, right? Well, that was not an option when you had a just slave owner that wasn't saved. There's also an emphasis on finding rest in Jesus. Tell you what, read Matthew 11, 28 to 30, and then keep reading into Matthew 12 and see if there might, in fact, be a connection. All right, so back to Micah. Micah, you ask a great question, and you pick a great word, charutz. Charutz can refer to something precious and valuable. It can refer to being sharp, diligent. It can refer to being mutilated. It can refer to being trench, remote. But that's a more obscure usage in Daniel 9:25. So how do we do word study? This is really important. And in fact, my doctoral dissertation was an extended word study of Hebrew and Semitic languages for the root rapha, heal, restore, which I ended up writing a whole book on Israel's divine healer and taking some of my dissertation and incorporating that into the book. There is a fallacy saying if we know the etymology, the origin, the linguistic origin of a word, then we know what the word actually means. In many cases, that's a fallacy. For example, if as D.A. Carson uses, you think of butterfly and say, oh, well, butterfly, well, it's got fly. Okay, and then you've got butter, so there's got to be something about the fly and the butter. And there's nothing to do with butter in terms of a butterfly, all right? Here, you're sitting at a desk right now. What's the etymological origin of desk? Do you know? Do you need to know? You get in your car to drive home. You're listening to me driving in your car. What's the etymological origin of the word car? Where does car come from? Or let's say this. The word nice in English comes, as I understand, originally from a French word meaning idiot. So does that mean when I call someone nice, now I'm really insulting them? No, not at all. However, often understanding the etymology of a word that's a more obscure word or that has multiple meanings can help us understand how the meanings developed, how the various meanings developed. Let me ask you a question. There's one Hebrew word that has to do with removing, wiping away. There's another word spelled the same way that has to do with covering over. One scholar says, well, they go back to original meaning, and it's the same root meaning rub. Huh? Well, rub on, rub off. So sometimes it helps explain things. So with harutz, very, very interesting. If you want to do more in-depth study, even beyond what you'll just get in the lexicon, a series of volumes I contributed a bunch of articles to doing these very kinds of word studies is the New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis. Yeah, long title, NIDOT, New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis. Five volumes edited by my dear colleague and friend, Willem van Gameren, great Old Testament and Semitic scholar and theologian and lover of the Lord. And I've got a bunch of articles in there. So you'd go and study harutz there more fully and see, okay, how can it have these different meanings? Are they the same root? They all go back to the same root. Is it possible that they're different roots because some of these different letters and phonemes in the different Semitic languages may come into the same Hebrew letters and actually represent different roots, different words? You can study that out. So the one I'd recommend most, and again, I've got a bunch of articles in it, five volumes, but not that expensive, New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis. You'll find great insight into lots of meaning of words and how they're used, etc. And then we look at the related languages. We look at related Semitic languages and see how these similar roots are used and can we learn from it. It's been a great learning experience for me through the years. If you want something less thorough and I would say certainly not as comprehensive and not always as accurate, but often of great value, the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament. So just two volumes. You should have that too, Theological Word Book of the Old Testament. That is also useful. There's a 15-volume one I've contributed to, the Theological Dictionary of the Old Testament, but that is more critical, liberal, even though I've got an article in there as well. So I would not recommend it unless you're doing serious, advanced academic Hebrew study. So you say, oh, what did you get? No, I don't even. Really simply, the biggest issue is how is a word used in a given context, right? That's the biggest thing. That's how we learn language and how is a word used in a given context. That's the meaning of the word. We don't have to know how it was used 300 years ago or 800 years ago and so on. And my favorite example, you don't go from how a word is used in English today and then say, well, it derives from Greek this, therefore it has this meaning in Greek. For example, the word dunamis, power, is miracle-working power in the New Testament. Dunamis. Well, is it true that that is the root from which we get the word dynamite? Yes, but when Jesus touched people and dunamis went out of him, he didn't blow them up, he healed them. So the biggest issue is how is the word used in context, but often knowing the history, the origin of the root of its usage can shed light on things for us. Okay, this is your last chance to sow into this worthy ministry, touching the Jewish people, touching people all over America, touching the nations, raising up, sending out laborers, helping to spark revival and spiritual, moral, cultural revolution. This is your last opportunity to sow into us this year. Why not? Why not take a minute? Whether your gift is small or large, we don't solicit funds. Normally, we just give you opportunity to get resources at reduced prices. But let me be so bold as to say, sow into us. It's the end of the year. It would help us immensely and help us to reach many, many, many more people. If you believe in what we're doing, sow into us with a gift, whether it's large or small, everything would be appreciated. Would you do that? If you believe in what we're doing, would you do that? 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978. 9978. One more time, 1-800-278-9978 or our website, askdrbrown.org. Okay, I close here. My bottom line, how was your 2011? Did it live up to your expectations in God? Did you live up to God's expectations for you? If not, 2012, we start a new year. Let's do it. Let's live it for the glory of God. Thanks for listening, friends.